It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host on WGN Radio. Thank you very much for joining me this morning. I hope that you enjoy the show. And we will start with a subject which is not a game bird in Illinois, and is a species that is generally hunted in the mountains of the American West in the most rugged terrain with, it turns out for me, very little success. Being a flatlander, I had never had the experience of hunting chukar in the high mountains of Nevada until last week. And after having done it for a period of 5 hours, covering 7.5 miles, smashing my gun to smithereens, falling down, nearly going off a cliff, I'm not sure the next time I want to go chukar hunting is, but I have great admiration for the individuals that do chukar hunt. And I can say in my endeavors in the mountains of Nevada last week, it is a sport that is for the fit. And it's a sport that you're going to walk a long way for a reward. And chukar hunting is, for those who do it in the American West, it symbolizes the economy of the American West. It symbolizes the open spaces of the American West and why people who are dedicated chukar hunters really have no interest in chasing pheasants or other game birds in flatlands or cornfields, because you chukar hunt in the most unbelievably scenic country. And you are hiking for hours in terrain that nobody ever walks in. A lot of people walk in the mountains of northern Nevada to begin with, but you're walking in areas where the vistas, at one point we turned after having walked up a draw and climbed over the top of we were about 7,500 feet, top of a mountain, not rugged, but just smooth top, ridge top. And we looked back to the north, and I asked my friend who I was with, how far away do you think those mountains are? There were snow-capped peaks in the distance, just booming and glistening in the sun. He said, I can tell you exactly. They're 130 miles away. Think about that. In Illinois, we think we're flat, and you can see the curvature of the earth. But standing on these ridge tops with a set of dogs, looking 130 miles back into the mountains with nothing but rolling pasture and prairie and breaks and rivers in between you and that, that's chukar hunting. So 5.5 hours, as I said, of walking through, there are no trails. You walk along the sides of bridges, and chukar don't like the flat country. They're always on the side of hills, or so I've been told. So you're walking along craggly rocks, and you're slipping, and in my case, you're sliding, and in my case also, you take a fall, and the only thing between you and the big slab of rock is your gun, and you use that to break your fall, and guns weren't made to be made to break falls, and when I hit this outcropping of a rock, my forearm on the gun just splintered like you would throw a piece of kindling into a fire. So here I am, hours and hours from my car with a firearm that isn't going to do very well should I find a chukar. And I'm working a young English Cocker Spaniel puppy. It was a spectacular day. And I tell this story. Here we are in the midst of a snowstorm and really cold weather this morning here in Chicago. And I tell this story because it reminds me of the multitude of outdoor experiences we can have if we so choose them. And I'm fortunate to be able to have a number of them. And so with the bleakness of winter setting in last week, I had an invitation to go to Nevada and do this, and I jumped at it. And I'm very, very glad I did. And I will say, having been a lifelong hunter of pheasants here in Illinois and across the prairies, there's a big difference between being a prairie pheasant hunter, a flatlander, and a hunter in the mountains for chukar, where you never have your feet underneath you in the same position. And I laughed as we were winding things down, and we had not seen a single chukar this entire adventure. And my friend who I was with, who's former head of the Game and Fish Commission for the state of Idaho said he can count on two fingers in 40 years the number of times he's gone chucker hunting and has not encountered chuckers. Of course, I was going to be the third finger. I commented to him, had a covey gotten up, how do you ever get your feet in a position to where you're going to be able to shoot? Because often you're walking at a 30-degree angle or more, or you're climbing over a rock, and if a covey gets up, you're in absolutely no position to shoot. And he said that is one of the great fun things of chucker. I didn't say that you would shoot into coveys of chucker. I said you would see coveys of chucker. And it occurred to me at that time that it's a lot like grouse hunting, and many of you listening have grouse hunted. You go into the woods of northern Wisconsin, Minnesota, southern Manitoba, Michigan, and you go grouse hunting, and you're in these thickets, and you hear the booming of a flushing of a grouse, and you hear it, and you have absolutely no idea where it is because you can't see it through the trees. With chucker, you're going to see them. We didn't, but you're going to see them. But then you're going to be in the position of not being able to shoot at them. So the similarity is there. In both sports, you've got nature's elements that make it all that much more challenging. But I will say this. The next time I get an invitation to go chucker hunting, I am going. Whether I shoot a chucker or not won't add or diminish the experience. The experience is hiking behind dogs in some of the most remote, picturesque, wild country that this beautiful country of ours has to offer. So in February or late January, you get tired of the flatlands and snow, there is still a game bird that is worthy of every bit of its reputation. That's the chucker in the mountains of the West. And I now have a little bit of a taste of it, and it's something that makes you want to do it again. But you have to be in good shape because it's not easy at all. So before going to a break, I do want to talk very quickly about the EPA and regulations, and then when I come back from the break, I'm going to talk a little bit about the IDNR, Illinois Department of Natural Resources, and online hunter education, which looks like it's been a great success. And I'm also going to talk about what's happening with BLM and some regulations on public lands. But before I do so, the comment on the Environmental Protection Agency and regulations and rollbacks is really evident. I was not aware of this, and I'm sure many of us in the entire outdoor community, if you will, did not know that once the EPA provides a ruling on a regulation, the incoming director of the EPA or the incoming administration cannot just rescind that. The exact process that went into place to put the regulation into effect has to be done to unwind it. And so we've all heard of bureaucracy and how long things can take in government and the checks and balances. So to undo some of the overreach of the Environmental Protection Agency is not just the President of the United States or the Secretary of the EPA saying, I don't like this regulation. I think it's bad. We need to undo it. Or Congress even saying, it's a bad regulation. We need to undo it. Because so many other regulations have been put into place in order for something to be adopted by the EPA, whether it's clean water, clean air, clean coal, whatever it might be. So rescinding a regulation can take years, and then at the end of the day, often has lawsuits associated with it. So this notion that the Trump administration, for better or for worse, is going to weaken the EPA, tear it apart, rescind all these environmental regulations is not going to happen. It will be years and years and years, again, for better or for worse, before regulations can be undone. So even if Congress acts, it still then goes to the whole process of what brought it into being in the first place. So this is one of those checks and balances, if you will, where the process to undo is unbelievably slow. And whether the regulation was a good regulation or not, or whether it was overreach or not by the previous administration or the administration before that, really is not the question. The question before us today is, how did we set up a system that is so cumbersome that to unwind something takes every bit as long as it did to put it into place. All the procedures, all the hearings, all the public notifications, all the litigation, the whole thing. And I guess it's an example of how if government is provided to write their own rules and regulations, as has been the case here, and the EPA is enabled over many years to write its own rules and regulations, they write them in such a way that it makes it impossible to undo the work that they're doing or had done. So I know that a number of you listening in the agricultural community feel there's been vast overreach by the Environmental Protection Agency. Regulations are cumbersome, and you were very excited at the prospect of, if you will, clipping the wings of the EPA and making it an entity that is closer to the grassroots and responsive. The answer is that's not going to happen anytime soon. The booby traps and all the back doors that have to be opened to get out of a regulation are such that it means it's going to be a long time before a lot of the regulations which have been put in place, whether they're good regulations or bad regulations, if the current administration wants to get rid of them, it's going to be a long time before they can get rid of them, and in many cases, they will not be able to. So if it's not a judgment as to whether they should or not, it's just simply a fact. The wheels of government in this case turn unbelievably slowly. I'll be back in just a moment with more on the great outdoors. And when I do, I'm going to talk a little bit about Hunter Ed and also the Bureau of Land Reclamation and a new ruling, which is a bit troublesome, not terrible in the end. I mean, not in the end catastrophic, but troublesome as to an overall direction. Thank you so much for listening. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America. 720 WGN, and first a message from your Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host. Moving along to the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and Hunter Education, it was one of the highlights and one of the successes in recent years for the Department of Natural Resources to get hunter education online so that it would be available when you're sitting in the comfort of your home for your kids who want to get hunter education certificates to be able to do so in the lives that kids lead today with soccer and all the things and ballet and everything kids are doing. And also for those of us born after 1980, for those individuals, boy, I wish I was born after 1980, for those individuals born after 1980, you have to get a hunter education certificate. So, we have individuals now who are 38 years old, and they need a hunter education certificate. So we were able to convince the state of Illinois to become a national leader in making hunter education available online for Illinois residents. The result, an incredible success. And a lot of credit to this goes to the work of Zach Lowe from an adjunct professor at the Purdue University and also the head of the Conservation Leaders for Tomorrow program, working with the state of Illinois to put this into place. But let's just talk about some real numbers. In July, the rule was enacted. There have been approximately 6,800 hunter education certificates issued in the state of Illinois under the old program, and an additional 3,200 online. So about 10,000 altogether, a third of which were issued online. So this is a huge number, and it shows the appetite of the public. First of all, to want to get a hunter education certificate online. Also, the IDNR has done almost nothing to publicize past the initial launch that you can do this. So it's a rather remarkable success that this many people have gone online to get their hunter education certificate without a communications effort. Sure, there are some complaints from the quote-unquote old-school instructors who think that everybody should show up in person and show up in class and drop everything they're doing to be able to come and do a program that can be done online. They don't like that non-human contact, but the whole idea here was to make things efficient for the lives of Illinois citizens, residents, so that they could effectively enter the field of hunting without the huge burdens that are being put on them by the state and the federal government. So online hunter education, fair to say, a great success, absolutely wonderful. And Department of Natural Resources is to be congratulated for finally getting it online and having one of the best programs now in the country. And we should only publicize it more. And I think you'll see in the coming years, probably coming year, forget years, coming year, a shift to where there are more online certificates issued than in person. And eventually the in-person program will become obsolete as technology continues to make advances, as it should. So Illinois has been a leader in this. Congratulations to the Department of Natural Resources. It's made hunting more accessible to the people of Illinois, which was the entire desire behind putting hunting education online. The last thing I want to talk about quickly before I end the show, and I thank you for being with me on this winter's day in the upper Midwest, is the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, has made a change to its energy leasing process, which for many sportsmen and women is not good. I mentioned before I took the break for commercial that I didn't think it was the end of the world, but I don't think the trend is good. So the idea is that there's a master leasing plan policy, which the BLM is supposed to go through, and it's designed to proactively balance energy development with other uses of public lands. That's its idea. Hunters and anglers have been working for more than a decade to strike an appropriate balance between wildlife habitat and energy production on our public lands, according to Whit Frostberg, who was president and CEO of the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, a great group for the advocacy of public lands access across America. The new BLM decision very simply says we're not going to do that. We are going to reduce the public's input into how energy leases are given, and we're not saying we're going to reduce public access. We're just saying that when it comes to energy leasing, we want to streamline the process and not have all these cumbersome regulations and hurdles we have to go over. So on one hand, it will definitely streamline the process. On the other hand, you might show up to go mule deer hunting or antelope hunting or sage grouse or chukar hunting, whatever it might be, or fishing on a BLM piece of land in the American West and find out that there's now a road and a well or a pipeline running through the area that you wanted to go to and you had no input. I don't think that's all bad. We do have to trust the people who are elected and put in position to make these decisions, but I hope it doesn't lead to across the board changes in regulations, which would undermine the ability for the actual landowners of this land, the American citizens, to have input as to where things should go when it comes to drilling and leasing, energy leasing, as it relates to our ability to utilize these public lands. It's not a slippery slope if it's managed correctly. It's a terrible slippery slope if it's not, and the door has now been opened by the actions of Secretary Zinke on this. Again, on the surface, it's troubling. If it's managed well, it's an opportunity to extract resources while providing public recreation. If it's not, we'll have a further discussion on it. Thanks so much for listening. You've been very kind to do so. I hope you have a great week in the great outdoors. This is Charlie Potter, the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.